You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of March 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, we'll find out why the Netherlands and Turkey aren't seeing eye to eye after the Turkish president compares the Dutch government to Nazis. My guests, Michael Goldfarb and James Boyes, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including why Scotland might have the final say over Brexit and the UK's attempts to trigger Article 50.
I will now take the steps necessary to make sure that Scotland will have a choice at the end of this process.
Plus, can you really perform surveillance via a microwave oven? Kellyanne Conway says no, but only after suggesting the idea in the first place.
I'm not Inspector Gadget. I don't believe people are using the microwave to spy on the Trump campaign.
And we'll ask a question that might render today's entire show null and void. Is politics just a big waste of time? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the journalist and broadcaster Michael Goldfarb and the political historian James Boyes. Welcome both to the programme. The Netherlands is involved in a diplomatic spat with Turkey this week, which arose when the country prevented the involvement of the Turkish government in creating rallies on Dutch soil. The rallies were aimed at promoting Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's drive for constitutional reform back in Turkey. Erdogan has responded by calling the Dutch government Nazi remnants. The comments have drawn condemnation from many European politicians. Michael, the language was brutal and ugly. Do you think there's any defence for what's been said?
No. I mean, I actually publicly posted because it's so confusing to me. I mean, we know that the Recep Tayyip Erdogan is an autocrat heading towards dictatorville, but you know, Europe is home to many millions of Turkish emigrants who now live and reside in the European Union, many in the Netherlands, more than a million in Germany. There's close physical proximity to Turkey. People go back and forth. They have a vote in the upcoming elections in Turkey. But he should also be aware that, you know, there's a vote, you know, in 48 hours. I think it's in 48 hours, but it could be a little later this week in the Netherlands. It's a national election. And one of the leading characters is Geert Wilders, who's anti-immigrant, virulently anti-Islamic. And you'd have thought that at this moment, Erdogan would just keep his mouth shut rather than create a platform for Wilders to stand up on and say, see, we told you, they are loyal to a foreign power, and this foreign power calls us Nazis. And it forces the socialist prime minister, Mark Rutte, to stand up and be almost as right-wing as Wilders. He's fighting an election, and he's got to win votes to keep this ethno-nationalist populist Wilders out of office. And I just don't get it, except that Erdogan himself is having an election later this spring. Maybe he figures this is the way to politic for his own voters in Turkey. But it's just wrong. And frankly, it's stupid.
James, obviously the ambition here from Erdogan is to, you know, get votes for his, we call it constitutional reform. It's reform in a slightly backward step in that it removes many of the powers that sit with Parliament and place them in his hands. Now, as Michael's saying, it must have been clear to him this was not great timing. But do you think ultimately all he cares about is maybe he even, you know, not just wanted the votes, but he knew that if this went against him, it would play into his kind of rhetoric anyway. It makes him look as though he's defending Turkey against all of these attacks.
Yeah, I think so. Michael put it very succinctly, I think, and trying to build upon that, You when you look at the sort of numbers involved here, when you see the fact that there are some, 4.6 million Turks across the European continent, all of whom can vote, over 1.5 million in Germany, I think that what you're seeing is clearly a deliberate attempt by Erdogan here to try to play to not only a nationalist instinct at home, but it's a very, very difficult and problematic game he's playing overseas. And again, in playing this card, which is so, basic, quite frankly, it's just a shorthand. You want to paint a picture of someone, you portray them as a modern day Hitler. We've seen this time and again since the Second World War. It must be said, let's be honest, George H.W. Bush used the same card to try and rally support against Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War. But here we see it much more dangerous, I think, because as Michael rightly pointed out, what you do is you exacerbate existing tensions and you just drive the process further to the right. And this, of course, is going to do nothing to ease any potential prospects for the European Union membership by Turkey, which I think by now is clearly not on the cards any longer.
But Michael, don't you think that's the point? In a way, that his actions show that the divide now between, we're talking about two NATO members here, but the divide now between the majority of Europe and Turkey, there's such a gulf that he knows there's no prospect of him becoming a member of the EU. And in a way, this again plays into that same kind of fury. This is him, poking a stick at Europe, saying, OK, you won't help me. You don't want us. I'm not going to do a damn thing to help you.
Yeah, I'm always a little skeptical about the EU thing. I remember I made a program some years ago now about anti-Americanism, and one of the countries I went to was Turkey, which had been a great American friend. I mean, the people of Turkey. And I went and found that, the country has had 20 years of economic growth. It has become quite modernized. Istanbul is still everybody's favorite, one of the favorite cities for people to go for a visit to. It's very popular with Monaco, I know. And they were less interested in joining the EU. They had favorable trading terms, and they didn't have to meet any of the political obligations as well. And I've always wondered whether the official classes said, oh, well, someday, aspirationally, it would be great for Turkey to be part of the EU. I'm slightly skeptical about how important that really is to the man on the street in Turkey. I'm more concerned at this moment about NATO. I mean, how can you engage with, your allies within NATO by calling them Nazis when you're involved in a fight with, ISIS on your southern border, a disintegrating Syria, Incirlik Air Base, which has been used for NATO sorties from time to time? These are the critical questions. It's like he's become so short-term in his thinking. This guy was, we thought 5 years ago, was a master political strategist. And he's become so short-term and tactical in what he does, as if there's no check or balance on him. And it leads to, it puts everyone in a very difficult position, because at a moment when the United States president, for example, is publicly questioning NATO, to have one of the key military players in NATO, and make no mistake, Turkey is a highly militarized society and they're an important member of NATO, to have it coming from him as well, I just think is making a dangerous world more dangerous needlessly.
James, it's fascinating because, even though he may diplomatically be, putting ties a distance for a little while, I presume they bump into each other in the corridors of NATO as we speak. The nations are there working together, supposedly. It's hard to kind of unpick all the things that go on in the background between the Dutch and the Turks.
Yeah, absolutely. Take this out of the context of the European Union and move it to the NATO alliance. And, when you recognise just how intrinsic that relationship is amongst all member states, that the underpinning of that relationship is, of course, Article 5, the idea of attack on one is an attack on all. This idea that, we should be a band of armed brothers together, effectively, is of great importance to those nations which are constituent parts of it. But the challenge, of course, is, and sort of developing upon Michael's point, that Turkey and NATO is an interesting scenario because, of course, whilst Turkey is of great importance geostrategically, geoeconomically, and geopolitically. But when you consider the fact that when the United States, for example, wanted to move land forces into Iraq in the 2003 era, it was, of course, Turkey who refused to allow them to use their land bridge, which would have been of great advantage to NATO and US forces at that time. So, you know, the relationship has long been problematic, I think, and a symbiotic, I think, of this tension within Turkey where it sits geostrategically between East and West, between Asia and Europe. And, you know, it has, I think, long wavered between where it wants to put its focus, and this is certainly not helping it tip in a European direction.
Michael, you talked earlier on about, you know, we had seen, you know, Turkey as being this kind of amazing kind of middle nation, you know, a great mentor for all of the people around it. But, you know, first of all, he fell out with Israel after Israel sunk a boat sent by the Turks, but then he made up again. He was friends with Assad, then he changed his mind. He was, you know, an ally of the Russians, and they shot down one of their planes. Oh, but they're now friends again. His mood, and it feels like mood diplomacy rather than kind of considered diplomacy. It feels like sometimes he's in a terrible mood and does something through, and that's another one of these instances, because whatever you think about the Dutch decision, the language, especially for the Dutch who lived under Nazi occupation, there's no way that they can accept that language and just move on. It feels very undiplomatic.
It's extremely undiplomatic. I mean, the one thing I was thinking about while you were talking about, Andrew, was that, you know, the mindset, however, I think in Europe is, well, we're Democrats and this is a bad government that the Turks have elected, and we won't, you don't push it further. You have to accept the insult. This is diplomatically, because someday there'll be a different government in Turkey, and the underpinnings of the relationship, the geostrategic importance, the fact that it's a, you know, it's primarily a Muslim nation, although still has a secular constitution. These are all important factors. And someday there won't be an Erdogan, I suppose, is the hope, and so you endure it, although he's about to change the, you know, he's trying to have a vote to change the constitution in Turkey that will give him even more power. And looking at it domestically, he has fallen out with all of the men he brought up with him when the AK party took power in 2003, around the time of the start of the Iraq War. Many of them have fallen out with him because he listens to no one. And I think that's always dangerous for the leader of any country, regardless of whether it's a big, important geostrategic country like Turkey, or, you know, a small member of the Benelux, you know, that isn't going to have the same degree of importance.
Just before we move on, James, we recently met a very interesting Turkish man who's not a supporter of Erdogan, and I won't reveal who he is. But he said to me, you know, look, you know, I'm not a supporter. But when I started talking about the coup in the summer, he said, oh, I'm sure it was an American plot. Now, he's a successful businessman in Turkey, mm-hmm. and it made me think that actually, you know, the line that we read here, we can't imagine that's true, but he was like, of course it's true, because, you know, that's where they're supporting the Gulenists. That's, you know, that's, there will be CIA involvement. Mm-hmm. Now, this wasn't a crazy person, but it makes you realize that Erdogan and the Turkish perspective, from where you sit looking out in the world, you feel there's a lot of people against you. And do you think that feeds into this Dutch comment as well?
Yeah, I think that when you look at positions like this, and we can see other examples, you know, you very quickly adopt a bunker mentality. No pun intended when you consider the sort of language that's being used here. But this sense that, you know, if you attempt that sort of an approach of, well, it's us against the rest of the world, it's very, very easy to try and draw a sense of national unity together. And we've seen this across a whole variety of platforms where very successful people have done this. I mean, you know, on a sports level, it was something Alex Ferguson used to do all the time at Manchester United, for example, us against them. You know, we can see other examples of it through politics as well. And I think that what you're seeing in Turkey is just the latest attempt to potentially successfully do that. And what he's most interested in, of course, is winning that domestic vote. And to a certain extent, the rest of the world can go hang.
Well, we move on to more conspiracies now, because Donald Trump's advisor, Kellyanne Conway, has hit the headlines again, this time for suggesting that kitchen microwaves might have been used in covert surveillance against the US president by his predecessor, Barack Obama. Conway made the remark recently to New Jersey paper The Record, saying monitoring could be done with microwaves that turn into cameras, adding, "We know this is a fact of modern life." Today, Conway has been back on TV to clarify what is meant by that as a general observation about technology used as surveillance. But with the helpful caveat, "I'm not in the job of having evidence. That's what investigations are for." James, what do we make of this latest kind of faux pas by Kellyanne Conway?
OK, so just to clarify, I'm certainly not here as a Trump supporter, but I think that we do need to be a little bit careful with regard to jumping up and down every time everybody from the Trump administration says something which is a little bit odd. I wonder whether when she said this, and we've all been on radio and television and perhaps said something and slipped at some point, I wonder whether what she meant was the potential to use microwave technology, microbeam technology, through some sort of a tech, and not necessarily a microwave oven. I'm trying to be generous here, because she also said that we could potentially spy on people through televisions by putting equipment in. Now, you know,
I mean, this is true now.
If you've got a smart television with a Wi-Fi built in and a camera, it's not impossible. You know, am I watching my TV or is my TV watching me? You know, she has a point to an extent, and one wonders whether it is a slight slip of the tongue. And I am being generous to someone who I have no great interest in supporting. But I do think that we need to be a little bit judicious. I think also, by the way, let's be frank about this. You know, John McCain has turned around and said, look, put up or shut up. It's quite clear, I think, that the Trump administration is desperately trying to change the agenda away from a very serious series of allegations with regard to its ties to Russia. If there was indeed an attempt to consider what it was that was going on in terms of communications between the Russian authorities and the Trump campaign, it's clear that what would have been had would there would have been an attempt to penetrate the Russian line, not necessarily the Trump line, because of course you move into areas of what is and isn't permissible for certain agencies within the United States, for example, which I'm sure we can discuss if we've got a bit more time.
Well, you know, I think that you get an interesting window into the thought processes of Kellyanne Conway and the president as well, and probably most of the people in their circles, because it does come out of, as you point out, there's, you know, little things that have come out in recent weeks. Last week there was WikiLeaks talking about, you know, spying televisions. By the way, this is not new. No. You know, 5 years ago, I was on a panel with the publisher of Boing Boing website, Cory Doctorow, who knows everything about everything related to the web. And he outlined this for me in the panel we were talking about, that, you know, your laptop can be reversed easily enough by any spy agency so that you can be watched down your camera. And they use it for compromat. I mean, if you are looking at porn, they can be looking at you looking at porn and what you do. And, you know, if you're a prominent person, you can be amazed at what kind of blackmail happens. So here's Kellyanne Conway. She hears the WikiLeaks report, right? Previous week, there'd been another report that had come out in the American press about the Internet of Things, which is something we all talk about, how, you know, you send a command from your car on the way home and the microwave heats up your dinner. And I'm sure that somewhere it went in through her brain and came out as salad through her mouth. And we have this accusation, the microwave can watch you. And I'm sure that that's what Obama's done. And then when she got called on, she said, well, I'm not in... I don't provide evidence. You know, I'm not an investigation. I'm just saying it could happen. And I think that's where we're at with this particular faux pas. But, you know, the thing about her is Donald Trump is famous for his loyalty. Mm-hmm. He demands loyalty. And if you give it, he gives it back 100%. You know, and today almost all of his Twitter statements have been about, don't be rude to my staff. It's bad for you. You'll get lots more out of me if you're nice to my staff, meaning Kellyanne.
Now, another interesting piece today in the New York Times, James, saying that one of the reasons that maybe the administration sometimes at moments feels a bit rudderless is because they just haven't got the people on board. The number twos and number threes in most departments haven't been appointed. Some hundreds of positions sitting available.
At least.
What do we make of that? How bad is it for the state of government, the effectiveness of government?
The important thing to point out here is that sitting here in London, the civil service is politicized to a very small degree. In the United States, it's vast. Going right back to Andrew Jackson's time, who famously said, to the victor goes the spoils, the incoming administration gets the right to appoint a vast array of individuals, thousands of people across the federal government. Now, that's fine if you're a political operative and you've got a long background in politics and you know these people and can use the apparatus of the party to appoint these people. Let's be honest, nobody was more surprised to win this election than Donald Trump. There was very, very few people in place to start the transition. And therefore, these people weren't in place to go forward for confirmation. That's point number one. Point two, the Democrats are clearly not in any great shape to try and play ball with this. It's also important to note that historically, American administrations always take months to fill the entire positions, some 6, 7, 8 months in some cases. But we're in a particularly bad case at the moment whereby, for example, at the Pentagon, Mattis is in place, but he's the only key appointment who is at this point. When Theresa May came over, the president sort of famously said, well, gee, the Brits are here. They're going to want to talk about trade. The Commerce Secretary, the Trade Secretary isn't in place. I guess I'll have to do it myself. And it reminded me of something he was constantly rebuked for on the campaign trail when he famously used to say, I alone can fix this. Well, the way he's going, he's going to be defective in charge of every sector going, quite frankly. And he's probably going to be okay with that. But it leads to great allegations of, well, who is running the country? These departments need leadership. And even at State, for example, where Tillerson has been confirmed, the State Department's going ballistic because he's almost like, he's disappeared. He's like the phantom secretary. He's not saying anything. He's not communicating the State Department line. And now he's trotting off to Asia. And the last I heard, he certainly wasn't looking to take the media with him, despite pledges that he would do on the on the confirmation hearings.
How many media went on the Exxon corporate jet when he was going to, effectively deal with governmental chiefs in Russia or in Saudi or wherever Exxon had business? He's still, he too has to get a certain learning curve initiated about the public side of being the Secretary of State. So,
well, we are going to move on because we're going a bit slower today. We're certainly dwelling on these topics. But you're listening to Midori House and me, Andrew Tuck, Michael Goldfarb and James Boyes. And now we're going to talk Brexit because the UK government looks likely to back away from triggering Article 50 this week. Speculation was rife today that Theresa May might choose tomorrow to begin the UK's exit from the EU. But a dramatic intervention by the leader of the Scottish National Party, Nicola Sturgeon, means that the event is looking less likely. Today, she announced that she would be seeking a second referendum for Scottish independence. The mandate being that today, the UK is a very different place politically than it was during the last vote in 2014. James, are we looking at the breakup of the UK, do you think?
I don't know. There's no doubt that Nicola Sturgeon's got a point. She said categorically when the vote was held the first time back in 2014, if I'm not mistaken, that if there was a material change with regards to the UK constitution, that would trigger a second look at this situation. I think she's got a fair point that certainly the Brexit vote would constitute that. But, just looking at the numbers involved, there's very little evidence to suggest at the moment that the Scots would vote for independence any more than they did 3 years ago. Of course, it shouldn't surprise anybody that a Scottish independence party, whose entire rationale is for Scottish independence, will keep beating this stick until they manage to get 50.0001 support of the Scottish population to trigger the departure from the Europe from the UK. Anybody, I think, who thinks that Scotland can just leave the UK and just suddenly trot up at Brussels and join the European Union, however, is going to be sorely disappointed. The EU has repeated again today that if Scotland were to go independent, they'd have to join the process of getting access to the European Union independently, and that could take anything up to 5 years.
Yeah, there's no Article 50 in the British Constitution. But then there's no British Constitution, so how could there be an Article 50 break it up?
But it is ridiculous. You know, the Scots were told, you know, don't vote for independence, because if you vote for independence, you'll be outside the EU and you won't get a chance to be in it. And then lo and behold, England decides to leave the EU, and you're kind of dragged along with it. So I think she's got a good point that it's probably fair is tested by the Scottish people.
I think that that's absolutely right, Andrew. I think that... it's interesting to me what this might mean. That's the material circumstance. During 2014, one of the big points that was made to keep the Scots from voting for independence was, one, you're not going to automatically get EU membership if you go, and two, the UK, the UK government at the time, David Cameron, was committed to keeping the UK in the EU. Now, that's done. So that is a major change, because at the moment, the whole process of Brexit seems to be heading towards a crash out, because there's no way in 2 years they can actually negotiate a thorough deal or probably even a temporary deal while the negotiation process is finished up. You know, I think that there is probably some... There are votes to be won. And the other thing, of course, is that the Labour Party has completely collapsed in Scotland, you know. And this means, you know, she can stand up and say, look, do you want to be hitched for the next 20 years to an over... Because it could take 20 years for the Labour Party to get back to power. Do you want to be hitched to a right-wing Tory England with all that that means... Or do you want to take a shot at going alone? And I do think that if she times it right, that it will be a closer vote. And it was damn close last time.
Yeah, I think this time she would stand a good chance, because I think many people feel that they were cheated during the last vote. We're going to end by talking about another Scottish MP, Mairi Black, the youngest MP in the UK at 22 years old. She recently cast doubts on her political future because Parliament apparently is just a waste of time. So little gets done, says Black. It's so old and defunct in terms of its systems and its procedure. Michael, do you agree?
Yes, I think I probably agree with her, but I don't think she should walk away from it unless Scotland becomes independent. And then she becomes Nicola Sturgeon's handpicked successor in 2035, when she'll be still under 40. You have an executive branch in this government, but it's part of Parliament. And people are wholly reliant, it seems to me, on the patronage of the Prime Minister and the people in her cabinet. You don't really get all that much new coming out of Parliament. Its work practices seem to be pretty hidebound. So I do think there has to be reform, but not so much constitutional reform, but I think a kind of social and mental reform on the part of the members of Parliament, who are still overwhelmingly male. You know, James will remember, you know, Tony Blair had this thing in 1997. He committed to getting more women into Parliament. They had Blair's Babes. 100 women entered Parliament under the Labour banner in 1997, elected, and very few of them are left. Very few of them were left in 2005, by the time Blair stood a third time. They got beaten back because... You can call it a boys' club, you can call it whatever you like. It has to do with the fact that, you know, the English love their traditions. You know, it's like Eton mess. It's just a great big Eton mess.
James, has she made a fair point? Because in a way, isn't she just somebody who's finding it actually frustrating that at 22 years old it actually takes maybe years to get things really finessed, you know, thought out, considered, supported? But actually, in the end, the way our country runs is down to Parliament.
I'm going to be frank. I was disappointed to see her to make this statement. I think she had a wonderful opportunity, and credit to her for putting her hat in the ring. I think it's probably that she didn't expect to win, but she did win, and she has a constitutional responsibility to her constituents to respect them, to reflect their views in Parliament. So when you say that, you know, it's a pain to come down here every week, it's like, well, you knew what the job was going to be. I think perhaps, to be quite frank, she got the job too young and has not necessarily appreciate the great opportunity that she's been afforded. I can speak to some degree to that. I held political office in this country when I was in my 20s, and I walked away from it, and perhaps that was a mistake.
Office.
Yeah. So I can speak to the idea that you can get some things too young and not necessarily appreciate it. So I think she should stick at it and do her very, very best.
Well, we're going to have to quiz him about his political office.
This is like you dropped this in the middle of the conversation.
That's a whole another program. Michael Goldfarb and James Boyes, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. I think the conversation is going to continue for a few more seconds. I need to know what party as well. And that's all we have time, though, for on today's Midori House. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Anthea Longo. And our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. There's more music up next. And then at 1900 hours, it's The Culture Show with Robert Bound. And we'll have more on the day's main news stories on the Monocle Daily, which is 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tack, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.